Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. My name is Paul Howard, and I'm a director and senior fellow of the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress. Our guest today is Joshua Archambault, the Pioneer Institute's Director of Healthcare Policy and Program Manager for their Middle Cities Initiative. Josh, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Paul.
Josh, I've got a terrific book that's been published by Pioneer that you sent me. It's called The Great Experiment, The States, The Feds, and Your Healthcare. It's introduced by the dean of the Harvard Medical School, Dr. Jeffrey Flier. It has terrific contributions from yourself, Tom Miller from AEI, Jennifer Held Powell, who's a Massachusetts journalist, Amy Lishko, who's a professor at Tufts School of Medicine, and then Jim Capretta from the Ethics and Public Policy Center. So this is really a collaborative work here, but the terrific thing that it does is it talks about at a high level the issues that are driving the need for health insurance reform, health care reform, as they're affected by state and federal tax and regulatory issues, and then really drills down into an issue that's going to be front and center in the upcoming presidential election, which is, you know, what is the Massachusetts experience based on what Governor Romney did there back in 2006, and how it has been changed, or rather how implementation has changed perhaps that original vision from Governor Romney. But just to lead off, let's talk for a moment, or have you explain just for a moment, why is it important to think of or recognize the importance of having state-level experimentation with healthcare reform?
Paul, thanks for the kind words about the book. You know, I think what's really important in this whole discussion is that we realize very, very quickly when you look at differences between states that a D.C.-based solution to this healthcare problem isn't going to work. And if you just take two states, for example, two that find themselves on the two ends of the spectrum, Massachusetts with our high coverage levels, and a state like New Mexico, which has, you know, about 25% uninsured, if you expect the same solution to be able to fix their problems, then I think we're being a little naive. I mean, if you just look at the difference in income levels, demographic differences, even the geography of the two different states, the employer offer rates, the regulatory regimes that are in place, what the medical infrastructure looks like in the two states, education levels, you realize quickly that you're going to have to allow states to experiment to be able to tackle the subpopulations that they have that aren't currently insured in their states. And so to think that we could take something that perhaps has had some mixed success in Massachusetts and somehow apply elements of it across the whole country, I just think won't be sustainable and won't work long term because it doesn't allow for those differences that I just mentioned, whether it's New Mexico, Mississippi, Minnesota, whatever the states are. And we've got to recognize that those differences should drive the reform and not assume that a federally run program can fix them.
And you alluded to just a moment ago some of the advantages, in a sense, that Massachusetts had heading into its reforms in 2006, a relatively affluent and well-educated population, high offer rates, I think above 90% in the states in terms of employers offering insurance to their employees, and so a relatively small number of uninsured, about 6% of the population there, made it a bit more manageable of a problem. Then also Massachusetts had some unique issues. It had a guaranteed issue provisions, and then some community rating banding that other states don't have that created a very expensive individual market, at least in that state. What are some of the specific challenges facing individuals and small businesses trying to find affordable insurance in today's marketplace?
Well, certainly the answer to this issue differs a little bit by the state that you're in. Some states have been a little bit more successful in setting up functional marketplaces for individuals, and others haven't. And just to give you an example here in Massachusetts, one of the reasons they did the 2006 reform was the individual market in our state was completely dysfunctional. In essence, the legislature had mandated what would be offered in the individual market, and you ended up with only the sickest folks still buying into that market. So part of the reform was actually some deregulation, believe it or not, that doesn't often get talked about. But they merged the individual and the small group markets here in our state and got rid of a number of the legislatively passed mandates that had been on the individual market before. It has functioned a lot more efficiently and better in the state. It's been really beneficial to individuals purchasing insurance. Perhaps the merging of the two markets hasn't been as kind to small businesses in our state. And I do think that in other states, you know, as they think through how do we tackle making insurance more affordable for those purchasing insurance on their own, whether they're an entrepreneur or just working in a very, very small firm, they're dealing with multiple levels. You know, the first one is state mandates. those impact those folks most directly, and I don't think often state legislators understand that direct cost correlation between when we pass a mandate and only those small companies or individuals will pay that. And also those folks are at a disadvantage because we're working around federal tax policy. These people aren't allowed to use pre-tax dollars to purchase their insurance like you are if you work at a larger company. So I think when we're trying to set up these functional marketplaces, we're often dealing with some federal issues as well as state issues, and making it very clear to our leaders that these all play a role in making insurance more expensive for individuals or entrepreneurs or small businesses, and tackling that first so that we can actually set up a functioning marketplace for them.
Right. I think Tom Miller mentions this in his essay early on in the book. Really, to some extent, because of the way the tax preference for health insurance is structured, i.e. it goes through employers primarily, that the individual market turns out to be the market of last resort. People drop in and out of it. They may not be in that market all that long, which creates substantial uncertainty for insurers operating in that market, and leads to potentially higher costs depending on how people drop in and out of that market through things like issues affected like HIPAA regulations, how long you have continuous coverage, and can you afford to maintain coverage if you lose employer coverage. So those are critical issues there, and you know, Massachusetts tried to address those issues. I think you just alluded to also. In effect, they had created some legislative potential solutions they thought would fix the problem by to say you have to offer coverage to anyone who comes to you in the individual market, and we're going to restrict the amount of variation of prices in that market. But that turned out to be a problem because it drove up prices to the point where the entire market became, you know, as you said, dysfunctional. So what are the lessons learned from the Massachusetts experience? Maybe here you could talk about what, Governor Romney's intentions were, or at least what was on the table when the legislation first passed in 2006, and then how Governor Patrick's implementation of the law has perhaps changed and raised some additional issues for other states to consider.
Sure, yeah, and we devote an entire chapter in our book on this because I think it's so important. One of the major lessons, and it may seem obvious to many, but it isn't thought of when they're debating the legislation. Implementation matters. Who's doing the implementation largely drives what reforms will look like in 5 to 10 years down the road. And we've seen that in stark contrast from when the 2006 legislation was signed under, you know, Governor Romney, as most folks know, and shortly after, 6 months later, Democrat Deval Patrick took office. It was largely responsible for implementing the bill. Maybe in some ways we should call it Patrick Care instead of Romney Care. But there are multiple examples that we lay out in the book in which the Patrick administration and appointees have taken the reform in a slightly different direction than what was envisioned by the Romney folks or even what was debated in the legislature at the time when they passed the bill. Just give me a couple quick examples. You know, we set up something called a connector. It's now, you know, other people call it an exchange. And what the Romney folks had envisioned was within this exchange, the minimum level of coverage that would be mandated or offered would be catastrophic coverage, that everybody would at minimum have this cheaper plan so that just in case anything went wrong, it could cover if you got hit by a bus or something along those lines. Well, the connector board has decided to pass something called minimum credible coverage. And this coverage actually is more generous than what existed in the private market before the reform. And as a result, it's been a lot more expensive. Another example within the connector in which implementation has changed it, the Romney folks had set up a market within the connector for set aside for individuals and small businesses to purchase insurance using a defined contribution system. This is where employers and individuals come with a chunk of money, and they each get to pick their own insurance. You know, a 25-year-old who's single interacts with the healthcare system and therefore needs a very different insurance product than a 45-year-old with three kids and who's married. And so that should be reflected. And that was the thought process, that we want to give individuals more control of their healthcare dollar. They understand how much insurance costs, and they're going to change the way they interact with the healthcare system and having a lot more competition. Well, what's played out during implementation is the connector has overstandardized the plans. They've said, well, you can choose within these tiers, these bronze, silver, and gold tiers. You're restricted in what the plans can actually be, and the insurers have chafed pretty heavily in saying, well, you're not allowing us to innovate. And the connector has said, well, we don't think people are sophisticated enough to be able to choose the plan that's appropriate for you, so we're going to simplify it for them. As a result, we've really have seen a lack of participation in this plan. The Romney folks had hoped for 200,000 or 300,000 lives in that market. We're somewhere around 25,000 lives in that market, and that really, I won't go into great depth, it's in the book. There's a reason why they're at 25,000. Really, they're lower. They cut a deal with an outside group to filter some folks in. But these are just brief highlights on why implementation matters so much, and those setting the regulations can impact how health reform goes forward. You know, I think there's a couple other brief lessons that you can pull from Massachusetts. First of all, health reform is certainly a marathon. It's not a sprint. Since 2006, the Massachusetts legislature has gone back twice to pass additional health care reform, and now they're debating their fourth bill having to do with cost containment. So I think this mentality of finding a silver bullet is naive, and we need to be really careful about when leaders sell any sort of bill, as this will solve all the problems. I think healthcare is going to be an ongoing issue as we go forward. The other one, and we touched on briefly, is that states are somewhat limited in what they can do on reform. They're often reacting to what federal policy is. And so from the high-level grand scheme, and that why we did the book, is we wanted to have this discussion of what should that relationship look like between the state and federal government on health reform? Instead of getting in the way of each other on reform, how can they work together? And we put together this framework we call competitive federalism that we think gets at a number of those issues. And then finally, I would just say one of the lessons that we've learned somewhat the hard way in Massachusetts, and other states have done much better, is engaging consumers. Until we have insurance designs that incentivize consumers to want transparency of price and quality, and for them to be able to pick the low-cost, high-quality providers, I think we're going to continue to have problems with cost in our system. We need to move in a direction in which folks have more control of their healthcare dollar, understand how much things cost, and can make informed decision about where they actually receive their care.
Well, let's just close out by talking about, you know, where do you think that this issue of competitive federalism and looking at the states as, you know, the laboratories of experiment for healthcare policy is going to go, depending on how the Supreme Court rules. And tell me if you think this is right. I mean, one potential direction, let's just say the law is upheld. The cost trends on the horizon, at least that we're seeing, that we've seen in Massachusetts, indicate that a lot more experimentation needs to go on in order to find sustainable solutions for getting high-quality, affordable care out there and available to people. And that means the federal government, I think, is going to have to be, in the long run, a lot more flexible about what states are allowed to do and how they're allowed to innovate in the healthcare space. And alternately, if significant portions of the law are overturned, I think the focus is, again, going to go back to the states and look at them as you know, vehicles for additional experimentation that might be sustainable and affordable over time. Given those two kind of broad visions, do you agree about that? Do you have any additional thoughts about where, after the Supreme Court decision, this issue of competitive federalism is likely to go?
You know, I do think that you're on point here. And what we're hoping and what we look to is history as a guide for how you get to bipartisan agreement on entitlement reform, because ultimately that's what this is. And the last time we did this as a country was welfare reform in the mid-90s. And if you look back on how we actually got to that place in 1996, in which, you know, you had a Republican Congress and a Democratic Democratic president sign off on a major entitlement reform, it was through 20 years of waivers. I mean, President Clinton gave 43 waivers to states while he was in office. So we were able to reach a level of national consensus on a very controversial issue. And the role of the federal government was to say, look, we have policy goals here. We're going to hold you accountable to get to the policy goals, but we're going to give you broad flexibility at the state level to get there. I would love to see folks move in that direction on health care. And I think the Medicaid program is probably the one that makes the most sense up front to be able for the federal government to say, look, we want to move into a direction in which beneficiaries on Medicaid have as good a health care as possible at the lowest cost possible and giving them a little bit more control and choice. Let's let the states experiment. I think very quickly we'll see within a 3 to 5 year window what works and what doesn't work. And then it's a much different discussion because we have the data to back it up. So I think welfare reform should serve as somewhat of a model for how we get to bipartisan agreement on this sort of issue, because even if the entire Affordable Care Act is upheld in the Supreme Court in the next week or so, you're still going to have 26 states that sued and are unhappy with the outcome. And so I think that we need to step back and think through a slightly different path forward on how we actually get to some bipartisan agreement on that.
I think that's absolutely right. And you even have, as you said, you know, entitlement reform, Medicare, Medicaid, and of course Social Security are all looming out there in the background and coming to a comprehensive, ultimately it's going to have to be a bipartisan adjustment to new fiscal realities is going to require giving states more flexibility and a leading role. And to understand how that leading role is likely to evolve, or at least hopefully will evolve, please check out The Great Experiment, The States, the Feds, and Your Healthcare, published by the Pioneer Institute, available on Amazon.com. Josh, thanks for joining us today.